ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Siri Hustvedt is an American novelist and essayist. And for 43 years, she was the partner of the writer and poet Paul Auster. Now, in 2024, Paul Auster died from complications from lung cancer, and Siri was left behind. And in the depths of her grief, Siri started writing. She joins me, Claire Nichols, today on The Book Show. Siri Hustvedt's new book is a memoir about her life with and without Paul Auster. It's called Ghost Stories, and it is an incredibly moving book made up of Siri's reflections, her journal entries, and letters too. There's letters from Siri to Paul, from Paul to Siri, and from Paul to his new grandson, Miles, who was born just 5 months before Paul Auster's death. Hi, Siri.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to have you. And I note, Siri, it's been 2 years since Paul died this week. How are you?
I'm sometimes I ask myself, how am I? How am I? And I'm not always sure, but, you know, I am I'm hanging in there. And one thing I could say about grief that I understand very deeply now is that, as with everything else in life, grief also changes. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that in my case, I'm 71 years old. I will probably take forms of grief to my own grave, but at the same time, it does change. And I think what happens is that the body begins to adapt to a radical absence in everyday life. And that's a change.
It's interesting to talk about an anniversary because it's such a specific measurement of time. And one of the reflections, the early reflections in this book, is that time made no sense in the weeks and months after Paul's death. You describe it, time was deranged beyond recognition. Are you able to explain, Siri, what that felt like?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And as I say, this is, I think, the second paragraph of the book. That I did not expect. Because, you know, we have a sensation of living in time. And that also, I think, has to do with adapting to the particular rhythms of a particular life. And in my case, it was a shared life for 43 years with the same person. And when that person dies, the rhythms and timing of everyday life become something wholly different. And I think that this is very much not a fully conscious business. It has to do with how we function. And when that ordinary functioning is disrupted radically, I think time is disrupted with it. And by time, I mean, you know, not the time of physics, but lived time, experienced time.
And knowing you, Siri, and your fascination with science and medical research, is this something that you then go and try and read up on and try to make sense of what's happening to time in this moment of grief?
It's true. My response to trouble is inevitably to read. It's what I do. Whatever, you know, some terrible thing comes along in my life and I start reading. I think that reading brings a certain distance to one's own experience. and also forms of comfort, because grief is an ordinary business. I think this is really important to emphasize, and I did feel it even from the start. Most people, if they have the capacity to love and they live long enough, will grieve. Mm. So, you know, I'm not alone. And at the same time, the startling realities of grief deserved, I think, exploration. And I read quite a few books about grief in what's called the bereavement literature. No one talks about bereavement, you know, except scholars and funeral home people. That's where the word bereavement appears in I think, the English language. But that is what is called the bereavement literature, and there's quite a bit of it. And I did some hefty reading in that material after Paul died.
I'd love to go back to the beginning, if we can, Siri. Are you able to tell us how you met Paul Auster?
Oh, yes. Well, it was between Paul and me. This was our little private mythology, but it was a big night for both of us. We met at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan, which is a place where a lot of poetry and novel readings take place. We met at a poetry reading of a poet named Ann Lauterbach, who we both admired. And I went with a friend. I didn't know Paul at all, but I saw this very beautiful man. I mean, he was very beautiful, standing near the door, the exit to the Y, in a leather jacket, smoking maybe a cigarette then, or a little cigar, I'm not sure which. And I said to my friend, "You don't know who that guy is." And he said, "Oh yes, that's Paul Auster, the poet." And I said to him, "Introduce me right now." And he did. And we spent that evening together talking. And I have to say, and I wrote this in the book, he didn't seem terribly interested in me. And at that time of my life, I had just turned 26. And I was used to men being extremely interested in me. So Paul, in a way, seduced me in part with his indifference. He was not aggressive. He was not flirting. He was serious and sincere. And by the end of the evening, however, the joke in our between us was always that I fell in love within 30 seconds, and it took him several hours. And I worked very hard during those hours to impress this beautiful man who was also a poet. And by the end of the evening, I think I had impressed him.
Well,
enough.
Well done. And I think it was a few days later, he left this beautiful note at your apartment. I've seen a picture of the note, and because
yes,
you've kept it all this time. Are you able to tell me about that?
Yes, I don't have it in front of me, and I still can't remember it verbatim. But it wasn't actually until I uncovered the note to write this book that I remember that he had written "Dear S" and then a dash. And of course, it's because he had no idea how to spell my name. At that time, my name was obscure. It was not the iPhone.
Yep.
You know, no one knew. And people didn't know whether it was a man's name, a woman's name, how it was spelled. And so he just wrote "Dear S." He had no idea how to spell it. And, you know, he had been calling me and I didn't answer. Again, that's long before cell phones. And I think I was in the library at Columbia University where I was a graduate student. And he said he had been calling me, and alas, he hadn't found me. But if I got the note before the end of the night, he should call me at this number. And then he signed it, "Love and Kisses." We had spent the night together. This is weird to say, but still, I thought, "Love and Kisses, my goodness." And I remember, you know, kind of, I think, but I might be wrong, it might have been an inward jig that I did in the hallway, but I was absolutely delighted with that note. So, yeah, that was the first exchange of writing between us.
And there was such an exchange of writing over your years together, Siri, and you've kept all those letters, which is just so special for us as readers. It's such a privilege for us to read these very personal letters between these two wonderful writers who have such a way with words. What was Paul like as a letter writer?
Well, it's very interesting because I've been thinking about this perhaps more now after he died. But Paul did have a kind of early and a late style, I think. And if you look at the arc of his prose over time, he was always a good writer. But the sentences got longer as he got older. He had a kind of rolling rhythm that he used in his late books that you don't find in the New York trilogy, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think this is probably even inside some of the notes, and certainly in those late letters that he wrote to our grandson, well, really an imaginary older grandson who would be able to read, of course. Little Miles is now 2 and 3 months old, so he's not a grown-up yet.
I'm keen to know, Siri Hustvedt, what it's like to live in a home with two working writers. How involved were you and Paul Auster in each other's work day to day?
Well, it's a good question. It wasn't actually day to day. I mean, you know, this is the old habit life, right? The habit life that I was talking about ending with his death. We would wake up about the same time and have breakfast and go to work. And we didn't see each other most of the day. So it was at the end of the day that we would, you know, have dinner together and often watch a movie together in the evening and talk. But we did read to each other regularly. Paul actually, I think, read more often to me than I read to him. It depended on the project, but it wasn't everyday reading. It wasn't, you know, we didn't have sessions of reading to each other. We would amass a certain amount of the work, and then we would throw it onto the other person and see what the other person thought.
How critical could you be of each other's writing?
We could actually be very critical. And there were moments, I cite really the two dramatic moments, which was that I had spent 5 years working on my third novel, What I Loved. And I gave him the whole draft. Actually, he read it silently to himself. And, you know, we met and he said, you know, Siri, it just isn't there yet. And I had that feeling that he was absolutely right because I had had my own doubts. And then I wrote it from scratch, actually. I mean, I had the pages beside me, but I wrote a whole new draft in 8 months, and he loved that draft. But, you know, that's a pretty big criticism. Like, you know, you spent 5 years working on this book and it just doesn't work yet. And then the other moment was he was writing the end of Oracle Night, which is a book I really admire. But the first two endings he had, I didn't like them, and I told him. And he wrote a third, and I thought it was perfect. So we definitely could be very critical, but I thought this at the time as well. You know, when criticism rests on a bed of love and respect, it's not so hard to take.
I know that, and I loved this revelation in the book, that occasionally your sentences found their way into Paul's work, and Paul's sentences found their way into your work. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, there were. I mean, I think I remember two very specific moments where the sentences were actually verbatim. And And Paul, you know, he said, Siri, you know, I think it was Moon Palace. Was it Moon Palace? He said, Siri, that's straight from Moon Palace. And there was another one. I think it was The Sorrows of an American. I said, Paul, you just lifted that straight out of The Sorrows of an American. He goes, and we didn't know, of course. It's unconscious plagiarism. And neither of us left those sentences intact. We changed them. But this is what can happen. I think it happens even more frequently with music, which has been explored at times. You know, people get some wonderful melody and it turns out it belongs to someone else, that they've heard it before. And of course, I do think of prose, of good prose, as a kind of music, and that music can stay in your head. Mm. And we did follow each other's work closely, so I don't think it's surprising, but it was funny. Mm.
Siri Hustvedt, your husband Paul, he started getting daily fevers in 2022.
Yes.
In those early days, what did you both understand about what was happening with Paul?
Well, there were other possible diagnoses. And the first one was long COVID. You know, this was, again, after the pandemic. There were people who had these strange ongoing symptoms. We had both had COVID twice, actually. And that was one of the hypotheses, medical hypotheses. But I was actually doing something in Chile, and Paul had a doctor's appointment with someone who ran a long COVID program in New York at a hospital. Paul went to him. They spent, I think, maybe an hour together. And at that point, the doctor said, you do not have long COVID, but I think you should check yourself into the hospital right away. And he made sure that he did. And then Paul had pneumonia. A very bad case of pneumonia, and was hospitalized. Pneumonia can be something that happens with compromised lungs, and they did spot a mass in his right lung at that, when he had a CT before he entered the hospital. So we had an idea then in November that this could be cancer.
And he was eventually diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer. He started treatment. And it seems, Siri, from your writing, that the treatment was almost as brutal as the cancer itself.
Yes. In fact, probably what happens with cancer is that, you know, the pain comes rather late in the story. And, of course, they did want to save Paul, and I am not a person who is second guessing the treatment, really, but it did become clear that the immunotherapy that acted on the tumor very powerfully, it was almost eliminated, began to attack healthy organs in his body. Mm. Now, there are people who do this immunotherapy and they're saved. I actually met a woman not long ago in Sweden who told me that she had a similar treatment for a very aggressive breast cancer, and the immunotherapy saved her life. So that can also happen. In Paul's case, healthy tissue started to be attacked, and it became a long treatment story of emergency after emergency.
Mm. And through all of this, Siri, you were keeping notes in your journal. You were documenting the experience. At what point did you know that you might make a book out of this?
It wasn't until after Paul died. I think it was about 2 weeks after. I realized that I couldn't return to the half-finished novel that I was working on, and that had been quite arrested, by the way, by Paul's treatment. Mm. Mostly for that year and a half, I was taking care of Paul. And but nevertheless, I did have some days to work, and I worked on the novel. And then after he died, I realized that there was absolutely no way that I could go back to those people. I think I can go back to them now, but it will be a somewhat different book because I'm a different person. Very soon after his death, I knew that I had to write, and I knew that the only thing I could write about was what we had been through. I also think that I had a huge wish to try to resurrect something of this man on the page, and that was the dominant urge of my writing.
We spoke earlier about how the shape of grief changes. Grief doesn't go away, but that shape changes. What do you think the writing of this book has done to shape your grief?
Oh, I think for the duration of the writing, it was a way to create actually a greater cohesion on the page than the writer herself had. I mean, in a strange way, I had a very good time remembering and in a way assembling the book to some degree. There was an adventurous quality to unearthing the documents that I found that I hadn't read since I wrote them or Paul wrote them. So that was something extraordinary, actually.
I want to come to the title of this book, Siri Hustvedt, because it's called Ghost Stories. And Paul Auster told you before he died that he wanted to be a ghost. What did he mean by that?
Yes. Well, I think in a way, what he knew he was going to die. And I think it was his way of saying, I don't want to die and I want to come back. And he said very specifically, I want to come back, Siri, and, you know, see what you're writing. I want to see what song Sophie's writing. I want to see what photograph Spencer is taking. So it was a bid for life. But also, you know, I think that his sentence lodged itself very deeply inside me. And both of us had talked quite a bit about death. And I mean, long before Paul was dying, we knew that chances were good that one of us would die before the other. And so we were not people who avoided the subject of death. And, you know, his desire to be a ghost was partly a desire to keep living.
You mentioned Sophie there. Sophie's your daughter. Spencer is her husband. And when you read this book, Ghost Stories, you get to know them both very well. I guess the question is, Siri, has Paul come back to you as a ghost?
He, on the day of Paul's funeral, I had an extraordinary experience. We buried Paul. We had a funeral. And then it was very small. The family came back to the house, and the rabbi, and there were a couple of Paul's cousins were there, my sisters and their families, and my sisters were fantastic. They somehow got food together, and I had a lunch, and then I left the gathering, and I remember very well thinking the widow can do whatever the hell she wants. And so I went up and just lay down on our bed in the bedroom. And as I was lying there, I felt Paul on the stairs. I felt him walk into the room. I felt him look at me. And I was filled with joy. It was an extraordinary experience. And I have read about this. I was not a novice, because the neurological literature is actually full of grief presences. Mm-hmm. And William James wrote about this in Varieties of Religious Experience. And the statistic that I came on later when I was reading more about it is that between 30 and 60% of bereaved people experience some form of a grief hallucination of the person who died. Some people have complete hallucinations of the whole physical being. I did not see or hear anything. Paul didn't touch me. What I had was simply this sense that he was there. And it's not so uncommon, but I am really grateful for the experience. How you interpret these experiences, of course, is hugely various. But what fascinates me is that there does not seem to be a culture in the world that exists without ghosts. Ghosts are everywhere in various cultures. And so I had mine. I do think probably what happens, and it's a hypothesis, is that the nervous system is really sensitive to deprivation. I mention in the book that if you put somebody in a sensory deprivation tank and 15 minutes go by, those people will begin to hallucinate spontaneously. So this is something I think that happens. And because one is so used to having the person who is now absent in your presence, I think the nervous system may manufacture this loss. You know, it will make it again for you in some form. But I really loved it, you know. And then later I started to smell cigar smoke. And this too, apparently, is not so unusual. But at first I thought I was really smelling someone smoking a cigar outside my study's window, you know. And of course, there was nobody out there. And then the cigar smoke started to come. It came often in those first months, often. All the time. And now it's much, much less. But I still have had it a few times. You know, not so long ago, I had a whiff. It's crazy. I mean, it is a little bit, these are kind of strange forms of madness. And it might be related to my peculiar nervous system, but it happens.
And is it a comfort?
Yes. The cigar smoke, definitely, and actually the presence was beautiful. I mean, the lived experience of the presence was wonderful, and I feel lucky that I had it. And I feel lucky about the cigar smoke. And I suppose even when one is quite hard-headed about what's happening, nevertheless, there is some, I suppose, enchantment involved that you treasure, because it is a reminder, and you have no, this has nothing to do with willing it, you know, it's completely unconscious.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. You say in Ghost Stories that this is the first book of yours ever in your career, Siri, that Paul didn't read before it was published.
Yeah.
What do you think he would make of this book, Ghost Stories, which is in many ways a love story to your husband?
Yes, I think he would love it. even you know, it's not a hagiography, as I've been saying. It's not St. Paul. You know, you get to know some of his little foibles and you know, warts on his character. But I think he would have loved this book. I think he would have been really proud of me. And I'm sure that part of the effort was related to that. I wanted him to like the book, just as I wanted him to like his memorial. And I realized after doing the memorial, which went just fine, what I was really worried about, I was so nervous before that memorial. It wasn't about the logistics. It was that I wanted Paul to like his own memorial, which is kind of irrational and ridiculous. And at the same time, I think that's how we are.
Well, look, it is a total privilege to have read this book. It's called Ghost Stories. It's published by SEPTA. Siri Hustvedt, it's been a joy to speak to you today.
And it's been a pleasure for me too. And thank you so much.
The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Huge thanks to producer Sarah Lestrange.
Make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen because next time, the reigning Booker winner, David Saloy, will be here. Until then, I'm Claire Nichols. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.